Dear Mr. Bickle, I can't say how happy Mrs. Steensma and I were to hear that you are well and recuperating.
I have
current geek!
Current geek! Uh-huh.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Current Geek. It's the film festival time of the month, a special monthly look at the greatest movies of all time from a geeky perspective. I'm Scott Johnson. He's Tom Merritt. And this week we're talking about Taxi Driver.
Oh, are you talking to me?
Uber Driver. No, Taxi Driver. Sorry.
Yeah, we're waiting for the remake of called Lyft Driver.
Lyft Driver.
Taxi Driver. Didi Xu Xing Driver. It takes place in Shanghai.
New York is much cleaner now, Driver.
Yeah, what would be... I know we're like diving right past like telling you what Taxi Driver is, but we kind of assume most of you know that it is a movie directed by Martin Scorsese, released February 8th, 1976, written by Paul Schrader, starring Robert De Niro as Travis Bickle, a taxi driver who is awkward, to say the least.
Yeah.
And if you were going to I'm going to go right into the remake of Taxi Driver. If you were going to remake it, where would you set it?
Oh, my gosh.
Because New York is cleaned up. Certainly Manhattan is cleaned up.
Yeah.
This was set in the early 70s, even though it comes out in 76. I think it's more pointing to that early 70s. Not that 76 was that much better of where crime is rampant. The city is bankrupt. And you know, the world is recovering from Vietnam. Or at least the United States is recovering from Vietnam, and everything is ramshackle.
Yeah.
I don't know what you could choose some Chinese cities, I assume.
Sure.
But you've got a whole different system of government there that I'm not sure allows for a Travis Bickle. I don't think you'd get a Chinese Travis Bickle. So,
the States, it'd be hard to say. Like, I think you...
Detroit.
Okay, maybe Detroit. And then set it in...
Detroit's getting cleaner now, too, though. It's starting to pull itself back together.
It is.
Maybe somewhere in the South.
Yeah, or maybe you just set it again in old New York. Like, maybe you just dive into the whole, like, this is
you're
a time...
You're saying just give it up
piece.
And just be like, well, whatever. Chicago. Maybe you put it in Chicago.
Maybe. Or they'll probably never make it again, because it feels like one of those movies that you'd be just in huge heat if you tried to remake it. Like, you just would never, no one would be happy about it. Everybody would say, you're going to ruin it. Like, I feel like there'd be so much pressure on anyone who says they want to remake one of these.
You know where you do it.
Where?
You do it in Mexico.
Oh, that's fine. That'd be fine.
You do it in, like, Mexico City.
Sure. There's some crime there.
and it's a good analog in that it's a great city, the way New York is a great city, but it's had some hard times.
Okay. I'm in. Yeah. I'm into your idea.
Know.
I'm
into
right now.
Maybe there's probably better choices out there, but that's kind of where I'm.
Who would you?
I think, and the reason I'm pushing this point is I think Taxi Driver is eminently remakeable.
Oh, interesting.
Because
really?
It's not about the story; it's about the execution.
Okay.
So if you get the right Travis Bickle, mm-hmm. and you get the right director, the right Martin Scorsese, this is a little bit like 12 Angry Men. You could put it in different settings. You could have a female taxi driver, but it's the universal theme here still rings true. And I think one of the reasons I say that is while Manhattan is not bankrupt, we're not still reeling from the Vietnam War. A lot of what Travis Bickle complains about in Taxi Driver, you still hear on people's lips today. The scum need to be wiped off the streets. We need to clean up humanity. You know, the world's going to hell in a handbag. People say that stuff all the time.
Yeah.
Today.
Yeah, that's true. Would you feel compelled if you said it in a modern setting? Would we have to go full, like, he meets with the illegal arms dealer in the hotel room and is, instead of buying pistols, he's buying AR-15s and, like, he's going to full...
Well, I think with that, wherever you set it, whatever the low, you could probably just do a little research and find out, okay, what do criminals buy these days? What are they using?
Yeah, that's true. I don't know. It's an interesting idea, and I hadn't really thought of it. It does feel like one of those that people would freak out about, but I actually think you might be right. The thematic elements are the stars of the movie, and I don't, that doesn't diminish Robert De Niro's incredible portrayal. It doesn't diminish anybody's role in this because they're all real good. It's just exactly
because I don't think you remake it as presidential candidate Palantine and Betsy. Like, you don't. It's not. Doesn't have to be beat for beat.
Mm-hmm.
You have you basically just need a situation where you've got a Travis Bickle, and then he needs, you know, a positive focus that is like Betsy, and a negative focus which is like Jodie Foster's character, and then you have him get torn between the two and be awkward, and you could play with those. You could change what those are.
Yeah, and you could almost just have any intense young actor play mm-hmm. play the role of Travis. The other characters can be whoever. There's a lot of people in this movie that I was surprised they were in it at all. I didn't know Peter Boyle or Albert Brooks were in this.
Also all alive.
Yeah, all here. That's the thing, guys. All, but yeah. This isn't me looking at a movie going, who's dead?
I think this may be the first one where I'm like, oh, look, most of them are still alive. Like, they had a reunion of Candace Bergen, Robert De Niro, Jodie Foster, Martin Scorsese, Schrader, and I can't remember if anybody else was, but like back 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They all got together and had a little reunion talking about everything. Harvey Keitel.
Oh, Harvey Keitel. Yeah, of course, still kicking. Yeah. What a weird way to see him. I went in here totally blind because I'd never seen it. It was on my list of shame of movies I meant to always see, never did see. So finally catching up to this, you know, 70s classic and the thing that really put Scorsese on the map. And all these people come walking in. I'm like, oh, my gosh, there's Jodie Foster. Oh, my gosh, there's freaking Victor Argo, Peter Boyle, Albert Brooks. People I didn't expect to see in this movie. And they were all great. But, yeah, no, I guess, Peter Boyle died. That's true. The guy that played Frankenstein, young Frankenstein also.
Right. So, okay.
Peter Boyle, sure.
Yeah, but I knew it wasn't completely... completely living.
We got to still be in the 40s and 50s for me.
But
to,
you could pull out all the dead people and still have a pretty good movie.
Yeah, I think you'd probably
you'd have De Niro talking to himself a few times by the cab.
Then. Yeah, just swap Peter Boyle out for like Raymond from Everyone Loves Raymond, and it all works out.
Albert Brooks is still around.
Oh yeah, he's still around. He's a loud Twitter guy. He's a lot
oh really
of, lots of yeah, tweeting. Lots of tweeting going on. Yeah, so it's...
You don't have to be alive to be a loud tweeter.
No, that's true. You can be well dead. You can be a robot, is what you're saying.
That's right.
And you can be a very loud tweeter. All right, so I'm just going to say it out loud. I think this movie's really good, and I get big shocker, everybody. Taxi Driver's good.
It's funny. We should couch that stuff to be like, we know these are the greatest movies of all time. Among the greatest movies of all time, how good do we think it? It sounds like it's up at the top of the list.
It's up there for me, yeah. I'm already a Scorsese fan, but it was always his later work, probably Goodfellas forward, kinda is where I'm in. I saw Casino, Goodfellas, what else? All the newer stuff. Like, I've seen pretty much every movie he's ever made, with a couple of exceptions, and this is one of them. I also haven't seen Shutter Island, which is new-ish.
Yeah, I want to see that. Apparently, it's great.
Yeah, apparently, it's a thing, and it's cool. And I like them all, and I really think he's one of the most unique directors ever. And this movie is a really fun treat because, in some ways, it's not like his other work. It's a different cadence in a lot of ways. Then say something like Goodfellas. Goodfellas, it feels like a lot of his movies adhere to that template and it works. That's not the template here at all. It's not quick edits. It's not crazy back narration, although there is narration in this, but it's not the same as you would hear in, say, Goodfellas or whatever. But it's just a very different movie.
The narration is a really interesting element because it is a Scorsese trait, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's not, it doesn't feel like he's narrating... Well, it doesn't even feel like he's not narrating a reminiscence. That's usually Scorsese's trick, right?
Right.
The thing about what happened back then, it's current. His narration is him writing in his diary.
Right.
Like, today this happened.
Yeah.
So some things are there. They're very Scorsese, but they're shifted a little. They're different.
There's more of this than I expected. Let me play a little bit of this for you. Hold on a second. Let me skip ahead. All right, here it is. This music. This is on all the time in this movie. So if they ever have a scene where nobody has to talk, they crank up this sax jazz business.
This was Bernard Herrmann's final score before he died in 1975.
Wow.
They actually dedicated the film to him.
Oh, I saw that and didn't know why. Okay, well, that makes sense. yeah, it plays throughout the thing, and it kind of threw me a little, but I think it's a thing of its time. Like, it's fine. Sexy sax time is definitely a thing, but I feel like it's so old that it feels a little discordant to me. Also, maybe it's supposed to feel a little discordant to me because...
Well, it's essentially Bickle's theme. Right. Herman said that he was trying to provide opposing noises. So you get the sort of the smooth jazz, but then you get the disruptive drum kit. Mm-hmm. You know, you get the deep brass and the woodwinds, but you also get the gritty harp. Mm-hmm. So it's trying to be Bickle's personality, what's going on in his head, what's going on, so that and I think it does reflect him, because he is very calm and jazzy most of the time, and then has these like crazy like eruptions of anger and drum beats. Even though they rely on it a lot, I think it's meant to kind of hammer home the fact that this is all you're getting. You're only getting Bickle's perspective on this movie, and therefore the only other music you're going to get is Late for the Sky by Jackson Browne when he's watching American Bandstand.
Oh, right. That song sounded oddly modern. I knew it was old.
I looked it up right away to be like, did they swap out? Like, was there a licensing issue? But no, I mean... It's just mastered really well, I guess, because it sounded too good to be on a movie soundtrack.
Actually, the entire transfer, the Netflix transfer, looked really good. Like,
yeah,
great picture. I had it running on supposed, you know, Netflix 4K, whatever that is, mm-hmm. and it looked great. Sounded great. Like, it really, I felt like it preserved really well. I have very few memories of this. I have the memory of you talking to me. I have memory of him aiming a gun at a mirror a lot with no shirt on, but wearing some kind of strapped on like a holster thing. Of course, that's in the film. And then I have that Mohawk moment kind of burned into my head that I've seen a million times in GIFs or whatever. But other than that, I really didn't know what to expect in here. I thought we were going to get like the story of how you go from quiet, nervous guy who drives cabs to mass murderer guy. Which right. he kind of almost
that
becomes
would be the expected
right.
Thing is he tries to he basically tells the story of any presidential assassin.
Right.
Right.
Right. And I thought he'd be dead at the end. And they even kind of play that up like he is dead. And then but he's not. Mm-hmm. And I'm torn on this ending, but not in a way that's like it doesn't ruin the movie for me. I'm torn on it in a story way. Like, it seems crazy that after all of that. It seems crazy to me that after all of that, he's getting this letter from the girl's parents thanking him that she's okay. That in the end, he kind of did a good thing by taking out all these like scumbags and
that,
stuff.
I think that's what's so great about the Taxi Driver story, though, is it's not trying to be a morality story.
Right.
It's not a Tarantino-esque descent into madness, nor is it a like, and this is what happens if you let these thoughts get away with you. And look where Travis Bickle ended up. This is a real state of mind for people. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's PTSD from Vietnam, but they don't hammer that point home. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just the way he is.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, he's not getting what he needs from society. And so because of that, his outlets are all over the place. He's going to porn theaters and thinks it's normal. He tries to make a connection with a woman, with Betsy, and almost does it, but he's just too cut off from the norm because he doesn't realize, well, you don't take her to Swedish sex education films on a first date.
Yeah.
And ruins it. But then he also has, even though he's confused, he also has protective influences. And maybe it comes from a bad place, but he wants to protect Iris. Mm. And so because of that, he does horrible things. And then there's the commentary of like, but because he was protecting a 12-year-old girl and because he killed gangsters, therefore he is going to get treated well in the press. And that it causes Iris to go home. And therefore the family is thankful. Is it because he's a good guy? No. Is he a wholly bad guy? No. And I think that's what I find so satisfying about this is you can't just sum it up in a quick way. It is a very, Travis Bickle is a very complex character, and this movie is entirely about him.
Yeah. It's, really something. It just hit me while you were describing that. A good actor for a modern Travis Bickle would be, in my mind, somebody like Joaquin Phoenix. Somebody who can sort of have that innocent look about them, but then feel like they're being betrayed and they get twisted and now they're strapping guns to their body. Like, just going that process that Travis Bickle goes through, I could see Joaquin Phoenix totally doing that.
I was thinking Jake Gyllenhaal too.
He could totally do it. That's another good one. Yeah. There's like, it's the generation of guys who could totally pull this off. This isn't me or Tom, for that matter, voting for a remake. We're just saying.
No, no.
It does. The movie does prompt you to think about it in a modern context. It just did.
Like, because it has such a universal theme to it.
Totally agree. Yeah. Totally agree. And even though.
And honestly, it has been pointed out, and I don't think Scorsese has disputed it, that Schrader's script, I don't think Schrader has disputed it, is certainly very similar to John Wayne's The Searchers. Mm-hmm. In that it's, you know, a lonely war veteran rescuing a young girl who doesn't want to be saved, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So in some ways, it's not even a new story. It's just particularly well told.
It is. And it's definitely got the backdrop 100% of the 70s in New York. Like, every vision or image I have of what New York was supposed to be in the 70s, and I only ever learned any of that from TV and movies, never nothing else. I never saw it in person, so I couldn't say. But it always looked like this. And this movie, in my mind, is maybe one of the most, now that I've seen it, vivid portrayals of ugly, ugly, dirty, greasy New York in the 70s.
Yeah.
And this gas wars and all that.
This is what I thought New York was when I first visited in 1996. And by 1996, it wasn't mostly that. Right. There were still bits of it around, though.
Yeah.
This is when you don't go to Times Square if it's not New Year's Eve.
Right. Right. And all that stuff has changed so much, and so many parts of the country are like that. But it just really struck me as a portrait of the time. It felt weird to me that this movie comes out a year before Star Wars. That seems just crazy. It feels like they're miles apart, but they're not. They're like 8 months apart. And I don't know why that kept ringing a bell for me. I was like, oh my gosh, Star Wars is like out 8 months after this thing comes out. That's just insane to me. To me, those timelines don't add up. But yeah, I would have been like 6, 7, or 8. I guess 7 or 8 during the time this sort of movie would have come out. Obviously, this thing is not for kids. It still isn't for kids. I was a little surprised how young Jodie Foster is in the movie. Yeah,
she's 12.
She's literally 12.
Literally 12. And the movie got some flack for that.
Yeah, I imagine because, they did.
You know, not so much portraying a 12-year-old in this situation, because that, you know, is an unfortunate reality.
Sure.
But because they're like, wait, but that's an actual 12-year-old actor, and should she be exposed to these ideas? Is that okay?
Yeah. Like, is she like, because there's things she's asked to do in a scene with him that are not, it's not explicit or any of that, but it's implicit what her job is and what she's there to do if she needs to do it. And the whole time I'm going, oh no.
And just that finale scene where there's all the shooting and blood, and she's there in that scene. She says she was fascinated by the behind the scenes prep for that stuff, and she was subjected to psychological testing with a UCLA psychiatrist to be sure she was not emotionally scarred by the role. That was required by the California Labor Board.
Oh, interesting. They have kids laws for probably any work, but specifically acting then. That's crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
She won something for this, right? Didn't she get at least nominated? Maybe she won some kind of best actress thing.
I don't know. Let me see. I don't think she got any Academy. Oh, no, she did. She got nominated for best actress in supporting role.
That's what it was.
Yeah, you're right.
And
Robert De Niro was nominated for best actor. Herman was nominated for score. And of course, it was nominated for Best Picture and lost to Rocky.
Well, what are you going to do? I mean, Rocky's cool. There's nothing wrong with Rocky. It's a little more of a crowd pleaser.
It's one of those things where you're like, man, they should have put it out in a different year. But the winner the previous year was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah.
And the winner the next year was Annie Hall.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Sometimes you get the aims just off a little bit. I remember 94 being a big example of this, because it was the year that Shawshank Redemption should have clearly 100% won Best Picture. And they gave it to Forrest Gump. And you know what? Forrest Gump's great. But that movie didn't deserve it compared to the other one. And here's the thing. I know that's, you know, subjective or whatever, but I think it's, I don't know. I think it's kind of a crime that it didn't happen, but sometimes the crowd pleasers get the attention and it's fine.
Yeah,
it's fine. So
in this
case,
arguably Taxi Driver, better movie than Rocky, but
yeah, if I put them together and I was picking, I'd say Taxi Driver's a better movie. The original Rocky's great. I mean, it turned into a weird thing after a few years, but
I mean, in Taxi Driver's defense, it won the Palme d'Or at Cannes.
Oh, geez. That's pretty good.
So, you know, it did all right.
But there is some artsy fartsy going on that the French would love. Like, I could see them just like absolutely, not just the French, but international audiences just embracing his burgeoning style that was coming. He had, you know, Scorsese was absolutely a guy to watch, but I don't know if there's a movie we've seen that's been, I mean, what have we seen in the 70s? I guess the Godfather movies. We have
Deer Hunter.
Deer Hunter. Have we done Deer
Hunter? One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
We haven't done Deer Hunter yet, have we?
No, you know what? That's a good question. Where that
we should
is,
get that one up there. One
I'm
I've
sure
never
it's
seen.
On our list. Yeah.
Never seen it before. But that era of film, this might be my new favorite, maybe, or maybe it's just because I just saw it and it's fresh in my head, but I really liked it. And it made me go. This is the weird bit, Tom. It made me go list on Netflix a bunch of movies that I just feel like watching again. And they're all kind of in this vein. So I went and tagged my list.
The other Paul Schrader? Because Paul Schrader made more movies without Scorsese that were sort of in this vein. And Schrader has said, it's not exactly Bickle, but these characters are all Bickle-like at various points in their life.
Yeah, and I kept
treating that kind of character.
I kind of feel like I want to track more of his down. I mean, in my case, it was like, oh, here's Pulp Fiction. Let's put that on the list again. I haven't seen that.
Deer Hunter's on our list, but it's way down. It's number 187.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll get to it eventually at some point in our lives. But anyway, it's a hell of a thing. And it's also, I mean, this movie was obviously rated R, but it's a pretty hard R. Like, the violence anyway. I think up till that point, it's just intense and, you know, sort of there's moments of pressure and tension that are pretty hardcore. But later, like when he takes on all those guys in that apartment or in that hotel or whatever the hell it is, It's gnarly, dude. That is some of the most violent gunplay.
They had to wash out the color in those scenes so the blood wasn't red. If you notice, the blood's kind of an off, kind of a blanched out red in order to get their R rating.
Wow.
They were almost going to be given an X rating.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. This is back when there's no PG-13, right?
Yeah. It's didn't have the option.
G, PG, R, and X.
There was no, what was the other
there's
one?
No NC-17.
No NC-17. Right. And no. There's another one now. No, that's it. That's all we have now.
PG-13 was the first one to come along and then NC-17 replaced X.
Yeah. And NC-17 would have probably been the one they were fighting not to get. And they would end up in our territory, or maybe today it wouldn't be that big a deal. But some of these effects, like even though I know they're practical and stuff, where the dude gets his hand shot or most of his fingers shot off that 44 Magnum. Good gosh, dude. Like I kind of felt that for the rest of the day. I was
because it was so abrupt. It was like, wow. Yeah.
It was really, really something.
So Schrader made American Gigolo, Light Sleeper, and The Walker. They're referred to as the Man in a Room or Night Worker films. He wrote and directed all of those, but Taxi Driver, and has said he considers the central characters in all four films to be one character who changed as he aged.
Weird. So those are technically in the Travis Bickle universe.
Yeah. The Bickle, the Schrader cinematic universe,
the Bickleverse.
They're not all called Bickle though. Oh. But they're essentially the same guy.
All right. Well, I actually kind of like that one. That either makes you you either want to say, "Oh, that's some lazy writing," or you want to say, "That's some amazing writing." You know what I mean?
Like, well, I don't think it's lazy at all. Yeah, I think this is him saying, "I figured out a really interesting character to explore, and I wasn't done after Taxi Driver," because that brings us to the controversy. Mm-hmm. Some people think that Bickle died in the shootout and that everything after there, because it's so uncharacteristically positive with the news clippings of him being praised as a hero and the letter from Iris's parents, that's all him having a dream as he dies.
Mm-hmm.
But Schrader and Scorsese I've sort of gently said, that's it's not what we meant. But what we are trying to say when we see him in the cab at the end, looking in the mirror, is that he's not cured. The fact that he got all that praise, the fact that he got a nice thank you from Iris's parents, that has not changed him. He is still the same Travis Bickle who killed all those people. And so your guess is as good as ours if he will do it again.
Right. And there's
I guess you can go watch American Gigolo to see what Schrader thought.
There's a moment in the end. So in his cab gets Cybill Shepherd again. And this is the one shot at a girlfriend he ever really had. And he blew it. Mm-hmm. Suddenly she's in the cab again. And she almost seems mournful that she's not hanging with old Travis Bickle anymore, which I think is a little odd.
Well, it's a really complex reaction that Candace Bergen gives, because it's not, I want to get back with Travis. But it's also like, yeah, but he's obviously not as bad as I thought, because, right, you know, saw all those reports about him.
When you say Candace Bergen, you mean Cybill Shepherd, right?
Cybill Shepherd, yeah. Not Candace Bergen. I keep saying Candace Bergen, don't I? I apologize to both Candace Bergen and Cybill Shepherd. They're not the same person, and they're both awesome.
Yeah, that's fine. I was throwing
management
me.
Management regrets the error. Cybill Shepherd.
Okay, Cybill Shepherd, yeah. So, but right after that, he lets her out. She's like, what's the fare? He's like, don't worry about it. And he drives off. And it's almost like this heroic, like, oh, he's okay. And then they pull this little thing. It's very brief.
Mm-hmm.
Where he's looking in his rearview mirror, he's starting to get that Bickle crazy look again, and then there's like a quick like film cut, like a and a kind of a weird sound, and then off he drives into the sunset, and it's, you know, everything seems fine. That to me, I assume, was like them saying, yeah, he's still a complete nutbag and he's not done being crazy. Like,
yeah,
this is just a reprieve. He got lucky basically with you know, somehow being a vigilante hero.
Yeah,
for taking down these guys.
Scorsese says the last scene of Bickle glancing at an unseen object implies that Bickle might fall into rage and recklessness in the future, and he is like a ticking time bomb.
Yeah, see, I like that a lot. I thought it was handled really well. Like, none of that stuff was heavy-handed. It all felt really subtle to me. I usually hate narration in movies. For some reason, Scorsese knows how to do it better than everyone else does. It just works.
And this one particularly, it's because you see him writing.
Right.
And so, you know, like, oh, this isn't like a cheap way of telling instead of showing. This is us getting a peek at his thoughts.
Yeah. But like, even in like Goodfellas, when it's most of it's narrated by, I can't think of his freaking name, Ray Liotta. It's done in a different way where it's like, it sounds like Ray Liotta's recounting this to like to an FBI agent or something. He's like, you know, telling it to people in authority or whatever, but it's so good, has such great rhythm, and you just follow through on it. I just think it's a thing that Scorsese does better than anybody else does. And that includes some of my favorite directors out there. Whenever they start putting narration in their movies, I go, roll my eyes. Don't like it. Feels like a cheap out. His stuff, it's part of the music. It's part of the tone and the rhythm of what he's trying to portray. And it's great. I didn't expect to see his big, he had a big fat cameo in this thing. He's in the back seat of the car with a very
right. He's
scene.
Like, he's an awful person.
Terrible.
Scorsese.
Oh my gosh. Awful.
You
awful.
See that window up there?
Yeah. And there were a lot of, how do I put this? I don't know if you would do it any different, cause it's 1975 and six, but the way, you know, there's some epithets and there's stuff in this that are absolutely no goes today, but given the context, I mean, you probably still keep that stuff in there, right? Like N-words and...
Well, I mean, I don't think they're no-goes today if you're making a movie that has them in the right context.
Yeah.
And I think Taxi Driver had them in the right context. Taxi Driver was not trying to glorify anything.
Right.
Taxi Driver was showing, like, this is what people are saying. This is how people are talking. And I think that's important, because you say they're no-go because they should not be casually used.
Right. Right.
But if you're trying to tell the story about a very important story about why they shouldn't be casually used, sometimes you got to use them to show the person who talks that way and show what that person is like and the situation that that person is in. So I don't know that you couldn't make this movie the same way if you're making the same kind of movie.
Yeah, I think so too. And again, you've kind of brought me around to this idea, by the way, that they should remake it. But anyway,
Well, okay, let's talk about a sequel.
Okay.
Apparently, in January 2005, De Niro and Scorsese announced a sequel.
What?
To Taxi Driver, of an older Travis Bickle. De Niro wanted to bring back the character. He mentioned it to James Lipton in an appearance on Actor's Studio. And in November 2013, it was revealed that Schrader had done a first draft, but that both he and Scorsese just didn't like it. And they were like, let's not do this. So they thought about it. They thought about making a sequel to Taxi Driver.
Interesting. What would that have been like?
I mean, it's fascinating. I could see where De Niro would want to be like, man, let me go back there. Let me see what Travis Bickle is like, you know, 40 years later.
Yeah. 05. If they were going to do it time. Correct or whatever.
Let me find him again. And where is he? And what has he done? Has he not been killed?
Yeah. That's,
you know, and that's how did crazy. That happen? I also can see why De Niro or like Scorsese and Schrader might sit down and go like, all right, we don't have a story for that. We don't have a story we feel comfortable that's not Godfather Part 3.
Yeah.
And I appreciate them having the sense to back off if they couldn't do it right. But yeah. Man, I'm fascinated by that idea too.
I really am. I'm bummed that it didn't happen, but I respect that they couldn't find a way to make it happen. A good example of that would have been, I don't know if it was the same director or not, but Color of Money was a sequel to the first one that he did, and it was about pool playing then too. But anyway, The Color of Money, which was like late 80s or whatever, was an attempt like that. And it never lived up to it. You said Godfather 3, same thing. Like it just didn't, it couldn't do it. And so I feel like at some point, if you got
Crystal
a notion.
Skull, anyone?
Oh my Lord. That's so true. And they're trying again, you know, with that.
Well, maybe they'll get it right.
I don't know, dude. By the time they're done with that thing, Harrison will be like 80. I just think
Harrison doesn't want anyone else to ever play Indiana Jones too. That's part of it.
Has he said that before? I didn't realize that.
They asked him like, who else should play Indiana Jones? He said, no one, me. That's it.
This character belongs in a museum, Dad.
Exactly.
Anyway,
should we talk about the scene?
The
one that you mentioned earlier that everyone knows.
Sure.
Here's the script for the famous Robert De Niro scene.
Okay.
You talking to me. Mm-hmm. The script reads, Travis speaks to himself in the mirror.
That's it?
That's it.
So he improv'd it.
He improv'd it. And there's all kinds of theories about where it came from. Clarence Clemens says that De Niro told him he was inspired by a Bruce Springsteen concert he had seen, where Springsteen said that to the crowd. You talking to me? Like in a, you know, obviously a more jovial way, I would assume, but, and he used it. There's also a New York comedian that Paul Schrader was aware of, who used that line in his act, and thought maybe that was kind of kicking around in De Niro's head. But nobody takes credit for it. Schrader doesn't take credit for it. Scorsese doesn't really take credit for it. Scorsese says he drew inspiration from John Huston's 1967 movie Reflections in a Golden Eye. Marlon Brando did a scene where he's facing the mirror, but that's in the directing of it. I think De Niro gets the credit for that whole series. You talking to me? I'm the only one here.
Mm. And so that leads me to want to talk a little bit about De Niro's tendency to work the method. Like he likes to get into character apparently, or that's what, where I don't know if he does anymore. Like he'll do things now, like
on The Intern.
Yeah,
really.
I think he just. I mean, actually, The Intern's a really good example of one that kind of works. But he's in a lot of terrible stuff these days that just seems like it's bill paying, and I don't know.
Meet the Fockers.
Oh, the Fockers movies.
Did he method that?
Oh, I hate those so much. And I love him. I think he's great. But
I love De Niro and everything he's ever in. You're right that the movies aren't always that great, but he's always great.
That's true. He'll elevate the content. Yeah. And there's no question about it. And he's in Scorsese's latest, which doesn't come out till
The Irishman.
Yeah. September.
Yeah. It's coming at Netflix, right?
Is that still the deal?
It's a Netflix production. It will get a theater run. It'll get
because they want award consideration.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Well, it's not even just award consideration. I think Scorsese wants it to be in a lot of theaters. He doesn't want it to be limited.
So. Oh, here it is. Mob Hitman recalls his possible involvement with the slaying of Jimmy Hoffa. It's Anna Paquin, Robert De Niro, Al Pacino. Having those two together is always fun.
De Niro and Pacino.
Jesse Plemons.
And a Scorsese film. Like, it's a retro.
Oh, big time. Oh, look, they got Harvey Keitel back for that, too.
Keitel's in it, too?
Yeah.
So, you know what? I wouldn't be shocked. I'm probably wrong. I wouldn't be shocked if when De Niro and Schrader and Scorsese were talking about should we do a sequel to Taxi Driver, if he doesn't end up going like, well, we shouldn't do a sequel to Taxi Driver, but what if we take it this direction? Yeah. What if we did a period piece and we bring you back as a, yeah.
Yeah, I like that. By the way, you know, I was making the joke earlier that because the guy who played Ray Romano's father in Everyone Loves Raymond was mm-hmm. in Taxi Driver, he's with the bald guy with the long back hair, or not back hair, the hair in the back was long, and he's passed away since. I said, well, just have Ray Romano come do it. Ray Romano is in The Irishman, so we've come full circle.
So there you go. See, further... further bolstering my theory.
Yeah, right? I like your theory. They're also dusting off Joe Pesci for this, so this is all exciting, I guess.
Dusting him off? Was he dusty?
Well, I just mean he hasn't done much, as far as I can tell. He hasn't been...
Has he not? Well, I always check IMDb before they say that anymore, because I will not have seen someone, then I'll look, and I'm like, oh, they've been in like three movies a year. I don't see anything.
So let's see. Actor. So The Irishman's the thing he's in now. Oh, hasn't done anything since 2015. He was in something called The Warrior's Tale. He was a voice. Wasn't even a movie. Then 5 years before that, 2010, he was in Love Ranch. 06, Love The Good Ranch. Shepherd. 98, Lethal All Weapon right, so, 4. Yeah, so kind of slowed down after Lethal Weapon 4.
Movie-wise, he has. It does sound like he's slowed.
But he's great, man. Like, Goodfellas sucks without him. That's not true. But he's amazing in that and everything he's in. Casino, twice the movie it would have been because he was in it. The fact that those guys are working together again, psh. I'm in. Sounds amazing.
Do you think he's funny?
I think he's hilarious, but I also think he has
a clown to you.
I think I see where you're going now. I was going to say something about that. No. What was I going to say about it? Oh, nothing. I just am excited about The Irishman, whatever that is. That's all I wanted to say about that.
Yeah, I'm actually unreasonably excited about it too. And I actually didn't even realize Pesci was in it. So. I'm looking forward to that.
And I don't really care about the Jimmy Hoffa stuff that much. Like, I know there's mystery around his...
Pacino is Hoffa? Is that right?
I don't know. Is he?
I think so.
I'm going to find out. It'll only take a second because this is the internet. Here it is.
I think I'm remembering.
You are right. Jimmy Hoffa, portrayed by Al Pacino. Robert De Niro plays Frank Sheeran. And his wife is played by Anna Paquin, Peggy Sheeran. Which is a big difference between those guys. But Jesse Plemons is in this, which is, for my money, is the guy you watch now. It's like, you know, you have these actors, you're always like, oh, who's in that? Who's in that? When Jesse Plemons shows up in the credits, I kind of lose my mind. I think he is so interesting. And he's kind of the same.
Breaking Bad, Fargo.
Yep.
Friday Night Lights. Yep. Yeah.
He's just something else, man. And his Fargo run was really something. He's kind of the same in everything. Like, he's always the same dude.
But Brian Brushwood calls him Fat Matt Damon.
Fat Damon, doesn't he?
I think Only because in Fargo, they bulked him up. He's actually not he's thin. Fat in his other roles.
Yeah, he's thin again in other stuff. But anyway, if you had to rank all of the Scorsese films that you've seen, I realized as I was talking to you, I haven't seen Raging Bull either. I forgot about that one.
Oh, yeah, that one's on our list.
A couple years later than this, right? And it was also De Niro. And it was also the script by,
1980.
Oh, okay.
Raging Bull.
All right, there you go.
It's coming up in a couple of years. It's number 85.
Oh, okay. It's up there.
Taxi Driver's number 23 on our list.
All right. Anyway.
Hope we live long enough to see.
Do you have a favorite? I mean, I think I have to say Goodfellas for me. I think that's
of Scorsese
got,
stuff.
Of all of them that you've seen. Because I'm sure there's some.
You know what? I need to look. I need to, because I'm gonna not remember. Raging Bull is my wife's second favorite movie of all time.
Wait, I want to guess the first. Hold on.
All right.
Give me a decade.
'70s.
Really? Oh crap.
Her favorite movie of all time.
It's not Star Wars.
Yes, it is.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah. But Raging Bull is her second favorite. She loves Raging
Wow.
Bull.
All right. I need to see it. Now I really need to see it if Eileen likes it.
Scorsese directed Last Temptation of Christ?
Yeah. Huh. That thing was controversial.
This is why I wanted to look at this, because I'm like,
Yep, he did that. That was a huge controversy at the time. He did that.
Obviously, my favorite Scorsese film is Vesuvius VI, his original short film from 1959.
Oh yeah, that one, really good. Yeah. Hard to.
Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore is really good.
I've never seen that one.
I haven't seen it in a long time. I saw that in college.
Yeah.
Yeah, Goodfellas, pretty great. It's probably going to be Goodfellas. I'm just double checking to make sure I'm not. Gangs of New York, I really.
Yeah, like. That's a good movie. That was his first DiCaprio deal, right? Because now these
Wolf
days
of Wall
it's.
Wall Street, of course, is the second, and that one's also very good.
Aviator was great.
Yeah, Goodfellas.
Probably Goodfellas,
right? I haven't
seen
Shutter Island, like I said, but yeah. Goodfellas.
Departed, great. Great movie, The Departed. Love The
Departed.
The Departed
is amazing. Yeah. I didn't enjoy it, though. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's not very. It is not the feel-good
like,
hit of the
really
summer.
It's really good, but I never need to see it again.
It is the best Jack Nicholson performance I ever saw him do. Ever. Like, unbelievable. Sidian says Gangs of New York has the tragedy of Cameron Diaz's performance in it, though.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
I mean, whatever. Well, you gotta go.
Only because we're talking Scorsese, and he's got note perfect performances and everything.
That's usually true. But anyway, I guess I'm going to say Taxi Driver's right up there for me. I think it's really good. I think it holds up. I think it feels timeless in a weird way, especially given the fact that everyone's got wide lapels and stupid polyester everything and bell bottoms, and it's the 70s, man. Like, straight up all over this thing is the 70s, but it somehow feels like it could have been made yesterday as a period piece. It's just extremely well done, and it has aged extremely well. And I would watch Taxi Driver again. Not for the kids, though.
Not with the family.
It's not
a family movie.
No, not even with incredibly well-acted 13-year-old parts. Not even them should watch this yet. Let them get older, appreciate cinema a little bit more, and maybe they're in.
You talking to me?
Yeah.
Well, I'm the only one here.
I wanted to make one other recommendation. A weird movie he directed more recently called... Hold on. Where is it? It's not Silence. Is it Silence? It might be. Hold on. I'm looking at it. Yes, it is. In 2016, he made a movie called Silence. Nobody heard of it. Like, I'll bet you're hearing about this for the first time, right? You're like, oh, mm-hmm. What? What the hell is that? This is Andrew Garfield and Adam Driver. So, Middle Spider-Man and Kylo mm-hmm. Ren. And Liam Neeson in a small-ish part.
Oh, Qui-Gon.
Yes. 17th century, they play two Portuguese Jesuit priests travel to Japan in an attempt to locate their mentor, who's rumored to have committed apostasy and to propagate Catholicism while they're over there.
That description sounds familiar to me somehow.
It's really good.
Huh.
It's not his normal thing, though. Like, it's very different. It is very much a, you know, 17th century. It's very much a period piece, and it's beautifully shot and dark and just great. So... If I had a recommendation for the one no one's heard of or has any kind of, you know, connection to the way they do other mainstream Scorsese hits, I would recommend checking out Silence.
So the last thing we have to address, and it's not necessarily pleasant, is John Hinckley Jr.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about him.
So John Hinckley Jr., we've talked about on autopilot in relation to Greatest American Hero because Mr. Hinckley and the similarity of the name. And of course, if you're not aware, John Hinckley Jr. attempted to assassinate President Ronald Reagan in 1981. Hinckley stated that his actions were an attempt to impress Jodie Foster.
Mm-hmm.
He also mimicked Travis Bickle's Mohawk appearance at the President Palatine rally from Taxi Driver.
Mm-hmm.
His attorney concluded his defense of insanity by playing the movie Taxi Driver for the jury.
Wow.
Scorsese says that he thought about quitting filmmaking over this.
Oh my gosh, really?
That he was so distraught over the association with the film between Hinckley Jr. and him.
Wow, I didn't know that at all. I mean, I knew that there was some connection to the film because of, you know, he had idolized the character or something. I think I remember hearing something about that, but
you know, this is tough because on the one hand, you don't want to make art that prompts people to do bad things. Mm-hmm. Netflix is going through this with 13 Reasons Why, and they edited out the scene where you see the main character commit suicide, because it has been shown that discussions of suicide will help reduce suicide, but depictions of suicide will encourage it. And Netflix decided to change it. So there's, you know, this is, we're not talking about suicide here, so it's a different thing, but you know, the idea is like, well, you showed a character doing all these things and Hinckley obsessed on that and fixated on that and wanted to imitate it.
Yeah. I didn't know about all those details about that. That's crazy. I mean, I guess I could see why he would feel that way. If you create a thing and it's purely fiction, it's imaginative, it's based on your life experience, all those things, all the, you know, that's what art is. No matter who's making art, that's where they're pulling from. And then to be told that, you know, a gnarly thing happened in your name, basically, because yeah. the thing that you made is really, really tough to swallow. And it's not that different than, I remember when the Columbine thing happened and everybody was saying, well, they're wearing those long trench coats because they like the Matrix and mm-hmm. it's the Matrix that made them do it. Or, you know, people take it to all
well,
sorts
and
of
that's
extremes.
A little bit of a bigger stretch because, you know, the Matrix wasn't telling you to go shoot up a school, whereas mm-hmm. Taxi Driver is showing a character planning to assassinate a presidential candidate. So mm-hmm. pretty darn close. And he wanted to impress Jodie Foster, the actor from the movie Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is like, so is the solution never to show a movie where someone does something bad on the risk that someone fixates on it and tries to imitate it?
Right. Yeah. It's really something. I can't think of any more modern examples of that in more recent years, but I didn't know it made Martin Scorsese almost quit filmmaking. That is just...
Well, I mean, he didn't.
Sure.
Thank goodness.
Sure.
And who knows how long that persisted in his mind and how serious it was. But man, I can't imagine hearing that a movie that you made caused someone to try to assassinate a president.
Yeah.
Like, that's got to shake you.
No, it's hardcore. All right. So the lesson there is go make a really controversial thing.
The lesson is don't fixate on movies, people.
Yeah.
They're movies. They're not real.
Yeah, they're not real. Everything will be fine. The funniest thing I saw recently, this is, I'm not going to get too much into why it was happening, but David Simon, who wrote The Wire, was the showrunner behind The Wire, which is set in Baltimore. Somebody was saying, you have no idea how gross Baltimore is or whatever. And he was telling him this. He says, haven't you ever watched The Wire? Didn't know it was him. That he was the guy that wrote The Wire. And it got me to thinking, oh yeah, we got to stop using like fiction as examples of why somebody should think one way or the other. You know what I mean? Like right. You just got to stop doing it. I know it's obvious with things like Star Wars, or it's obvious with things like, I don't know, things set in fantasy or science fiction or something.
Man, Scott, New York is a dangerous place. Haven't you seen Avengers?
Right. Can you believe that? Or I could say there's Travis Bickles all over the place if all I ever saw was Taxi Driver. Like,
yeah, right.
If I thought that everybody behaved as like the soldiers did in Full Metal Jacket, then I would have a skewed version of what, you know, there's just, it creates these absolutes are dangerous, man. So don't do it. Your entertainment is there for entertainment, not for
it may be metaphorically or poetically true, but it's not a source of facts.
No. That's right. All right. Well, I feel like we've done some good in the world today.
Yeah, maybe.
Hey, if you enjoyed the show, I think that's great. And if you like us, go support us. Patreon.com/currentgeek. We'll be back with a news-oriented episode next week. When do you travel? You're traveling soon.
Oh, not for a couple more weeks.
Okay, yeah, so we're good.
I'll be around next week.
All right, sweet. So we'll do that next week. In the meantime, you can use our website. Head on over there to currentgeek.com, and you can get all the archives of the show, send us contacts, whatever you want to do. We'd love to hear from you. Tom, do you have anything you'd like to mention before we go?
Well, don't forget, next month's Film Fest movie will be our first Kurosawa film, 1954 Seven Samurai.
Ooh, that's very exciting to me.
Available on the Criterion channel if you are a subscriber, or you can buy or rent it, which is probably what I'll do. I'm looking forward to that. I also want to direct people to It's a Thing. Hollywood and I called Lil Nas X mm-hmm. months ago on It's a Thing.
Wow.
And Lil Nas X just broke the record for most weeks at number one. So if you want to appear smarter in front of other people, check out It's a Thing at itsathing.com.
You guys really had him on there? That's amazing. Is that true?
We didn't have him on.
Oh.
We called it.
Oh, okay.
It's a Thing's point is to say, hey, this is a thing. And we called that in like March.
Wow, that's fantastic. Take your old horse to the old hotel room. Or how's it go? I'm going to ride my horse to the
latest one with BTS.
Yeah. Hotel room. I'm going to ride. Maybe not.
Not hotel room, no.
Have a fantastic week, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week we cover a lawsuit where Activision Blizzard is invoking free speech protection and remind you about the awesome events happening at Gen Con this week. As covered on The Instance and other news outlets, Blizzard co-founder Frank Pierce is leaving the company, so change is in the air at Activision Blizzard. But one thing that never changes is the fact that this company is always in interesting litigation, including the Warcraft Diablo-related patent case we covered last week. This week, we cover a different type of lawsuit, that being a trademark infringement lawsuit brought by AM General, the maker of Humvee vehicles, against Activision for showing these same vehicles in the Call of Duty game series. AM General filed this lawsuit in late 2017, claiming that the unauthorized use of images of their Humvee vehicles in the Call of Duty games has allowed Activision to reap billions of dollars off the goodwill of their company. While we have seen similar claims in recent segments on personality rights, such as those related to iconic dance moves, in the trademark infringement context, these legal claims are much harder to win. This is in part because U.S. courts have used First Amendment concerns to hold that trademark owners cannot sue over use of their brands in creative works, unless the marks are completely irrelevant to the work, or if the author expressly misleads consumers. This is an interesting use of First Amendment protection, as they do not normally apply between two private, non-government parties. So for example, it's easy to sue if you put a branded cereal box in a TV sitcom scene without authorization, as any old cereal box could have been used in most of those cases. But that is not the context here. AM General has supplied the U.S. military with Humvees for nearly 40 years, and that has made the vehicle a fixture in war movies, telecasts, and news shows. So in the context of war video games, Activision is able to make the case that Humvees are artistically relevant to these games. So the first exception of the mark being completely irrelevant to the creative work does not apply here. Plus, the use of Humvees is minimal in the overall context of the game being reviewed, being on screen for 10 minutes out of about 35 hours of gameplay. The other factor of consumer misleading is also not pertinent here, as Activision does not draw any association with AM General as the source of the games. So in this context, the bottom line is, AM General probably loses this trademark lawsuit based on First Amendment free speech protections, an interesting shield for a company like Activision. Never doubt the ability of Activision Blizzard to remain getting in interesting lawsuits, though. A final special note, since this is Gen Con week in Indianapolis. You can find the Legal Geek seminars on Thursday at 1 p.m. in the Crown Plaza Hotel, and on Friday at 10 a.m. in the JW Marriott Hotel. Friend of the show Justin Robert Young is also putting on a couple seminars, and you can check those out in the Convention Center on Friday at 8 p.m. and on Saturday at 10 a.m. Please reach out on Twitter if you want to track us down this weekend. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.